The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
This is Chatter. I'm Shane Harris. This week, journalist Martine Powers on the empty grave of Comrade Bishop.
I'd get emails from people that were like, oh, I'm from Grenada, and I really appreciate you like talking about this history. And also, like, there's this thing about the bodies that you should know. Have you heard about the thing with the bodies? Like, the bodies are missing. Like, maybe you should look into that. Essentially, 6 days after Bishop is killed, the U.S. is now in control of the island. That's where it starts to get complicated, where there's this question of, okay, so when exactly did these bodies disappear and who had control of them when they did disappear? What Grenadians say that I think is a compelling argument is that the U.S. is also, like, obsessed with making sure that we have the remains of people.
Absolutely.
Grenadians are like, we just want the same thing. Like, we're just asking for one group of people that we'd really like to be able to bury. And Grenadians have felt that the U.S. government in particular hasn't been that helpful in the years since in trying to track down those answers.
Martine Powers, welcome to Chatter.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's lovely to have you here. And we should tell people, you and I have been sitting across from each other in a podcast studio many times.
Many, many times.
It's just that usually it's you asking the questions.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Usually it's there's some like national crisis or international crisis happening. And then we on the Post Reports team at the Post were like, oh my God, who can we get to talk to us in the next 90 seconds right now? And then you are always so game. And we're like, Shane, get in the studio
get
now.
In the studio
like,
now.
What's happening in Ukraine? What's happening here? What's happening there? And so. Yeah. So this is a little bit less of a crisis moment, which is good.
Yes, that's true. Exactly. It's a little easier. And it's funny because people are probably guessing Martine is the host of Post Reports, our daily podcast of the Post. That's not why she's here today. We'll get to that in a second. But as you had stepped away to work on this project, we're going to talk about, I had done like a guest host slot and filled in a couple of times, which was super cool. That was fun.
You were amazing too.
I like doing it.
Such a pleasure to listen.
You guys are great on our team. But we're here today to talk about your new podcast, which is a new narrative podcast that The Post has produced that you've been working on for 2 years now,
basically, roughly, yeah.
Right? Called The Empty Grave of Comrade Bishop. So I'm going to start with the most obvious question. Who was Comrade Bishop? Tell us.
So Comrade Bishop is a reference to Prime Minister Maurice Bishop, who was the Prime Minister of Grenada in the early 1980s. And he had led a revolution against a dictator. He was a socialist. Some people at the time would have said that he was veering into communism, and that also made him very controversial. But he was this, in many ways, incredibly popular, just like charismatic, and really beloved leader in Grenada, who kind of spoke to the hopes and dreams of a lot of Grenadians, a lot of West Indians, but really Black people around the world who knew who he was and were inspired by his speeches and his ideas and how he kind of fit into the Black Power movement internationally.
Yeah, and a really incredibly forceful revolutionary political leader. We'll talk about him. So the other part of the title, The Empty Grave. So this is what does that refer to that sets up the mystery that is at the heart of this podcast?
Yeah. So in October of 1983, Maurice Bishop was assassinated. He was killed by other Grenadians, actually members of his own army, execution style, essentially during an attempted coup. He was killed along with some of his cabinet members and some of his other supporters. And the mystery that we have been trying to investigate is what happened to his body. So his body disappeared, the bodies of his cabinet members disappeared, and the people who were killed with him. Their families to this day have never been able to bury them. And there's this question of where did his body go? How did it disappear? And because the U.S. ends up invading Grenada a week after Maurice Bishop was killed, there are questions about whether the U.S. government had some involvement in the fact that his body is missing.
Right. And that's a really interesting part of the international intrigue of it. And for people in Grenada, the missing remains of Bishop and the people who were assassinated along with him, it's not a trivial matter. I mean, this is very much like an open wound and kind of a subject of speculation and theorizing and grief in the society.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about that. That comes across in the story, but how does this loom in the sort of public imagination in Grenada today?
Yeah, well, I mean, and we'll talk more about this, but in the aftermath, especially of this U.S. invasion, just talking about the revolution was not a thing that people did. There was just so much trauma there, and it was like truly the most turbulent, chaotic week, like, in the history of this country. And so it just feels like no one wanted to talk about it for a while. And then after a couple of decades, it became more of a source of open conversation where there were these like lingering questions around what happened to Bishop's body, but also like, what did this period mean to us? Like the Americans who came and like quote unquote rescued us, were they our rescuers? Maybe they weren't our rescuers. Like maybe I feel differently about this than I did 20 years ago. And like, what does this period represent? What did Maurice Bishop represent? He was incredibly beloved. And also there were plenty of people in Grenada who say that their lives were worse and not better because of Maurice Bishop, and that there's been this kind of rethinking or just grappling with what this 4.5 year revolutionary period in this tiny Caribbean island, what it means to that island and what it means to the rest of the world. And that I think a lot of those feelings are wrapped up in this one question around his body.
Yeah, and where is he? And let's talk about that revolutionary period, because that leads up to, you know, the U.S. invasion in 83, which I think most listeners of the podcast will remember Grenada probably for that. Like they remember maybe where they were, they've read about it in history. Mm-hmm. But talk a bit about, you know, when Bishop comes to power, what's it like in Grenada and why does he succeed as this young leader there?
Yeah. So, I mean, a lot of it is, I think, really comes down to personality. Mm. We, especially because Grenada is so small, I mean, people who knew Bishop as an adult are generally people who also knew Bishop as a child. And so we just heard all these stories about him, even in high school, like being the president of like the student council and the school newspaper and the captain of the tennis team, and that everyone just admired him, loved to be around him. And that really extended into his young adulthood. He went and lived in London for a while and then came back to Grenada. And he was from this middle class, maybe upper middle class family who were not necessarily like talking about like revolutionary ideas at home, you know, that they were lighter skinned, that they were kind of upwardly mobile. And I think that a family that was generally interested in, you know, here's our one son, we want him educated in London to become a lawyer, come back, be a fancy lawyer and like have a nice office and kind of live that sort of life in
Grenada.
Typical
middle class kind of dream and aspirations.
Yeah, exactly. But when he goes to London, he starts to become taken with these ideas around socialism.
This is mid-70s?
Yes, mid-70s, and Marxism, and he meets, you know, he meets Cubans, and he meets Americans in the Black Power movement, and he meets other West Indians who are trying to stage revolutions in their own countries, and he also experiences firsthand a lot of the discrimination against Black people and especially West Indians in London, and that gets him thinking about, like, what are we trying to prove to all these white people? Like, why are we trying to kind of support a system that doesn't see us as an important part of that system? And so when he comes back with all these revolutionary ideas and connects with other smart, well-read, charismatic young people, they, you know, really kind of capture the imagination of this country, and are able to commands a pretty incredible amount of support, and to basically say we should try this a different way, we should start our own government, and that we should do things differently.
You have these some really wonderful stories of people who knew him, and as you mentioned, it was such a small community that kind of everybody felt like they knew each other. And one of the stories that stuck out from when he was in London is he's remarking on how there's like a ceremony, I think, where the Queen is present.
Yeah.
And the people who he's with don't show nearly the kind of deference and respect to Queen Elizabeth as people would in Grenada.
Yeah.
And it's kind of this moment of like, why are we bowing down to this sovereign if the people in England don't seem to be taking her that seriously?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, especially back when Bishop would have been a kid. So like, I guess 50s, 60s. You know, like a member of the royal family comes and visits your island maybe once every 5 years, once every 10 years. And when they come, it is a huge deal. And you have basically students from every school in the country who are standing out in the hot sun for hours, like waiting to see a glimpse of the queen. And everyone's supposed to be standing up straight so that they could show the queen or the princess or whatever, like how like together this island is, and that he kind of apparently in letters back to his family was reflecting on that he goes to the UK and everyone's like, yeah, it's we don't stand at attention and make a big deal every time you hear God Save the Queen, and that he just felt like, you know, that they'd sort of been had in some ways.
How supportive were his parents and his family of this revolutionary posture that he was taking? I mean, which was not at all why they sent him off to London.
Yeah, I think at the beginning they had questions, but at least from what I understand and from the people that we've interviewed, that once he came back and it was clear that these ideas that he was putting forth were really resonating with Grenadians, that they were largely supportive of him and of the others that he was working with. The other part of this is that there was I think a lot of people would call him a dictator in Grenada at the time, Sir Eric Gary. Mm-hmm. If you ever hear him talk, he has this like Shakespearean accent, you know, like very, very like trying to sound British.
Mm-hmm.
And he had been the premier of Grenada, and then when Grenada got independence, he automatically became the prime minister. And that was there were protests and strikes around that because people thought that Eric Gary was corrupt. People, you know, he had what people call the Mongoose Gang, which was essentially like his own group of quote-unquote thugs who would, you know, go around, beat people up, sometimes kill people if they were sort of out of step with what Eric Gary wanted. And so I think a lot of the reasons why Maurice Bishop's family was willing to support him in this revolution was because they were seeing Eric Gary and what he was doing to the country and were adamant that something needed to change.
And you have some great audio of Maurice Bishop speaking and giving speeches, and he's a really marvelous orator, and you can see how he understands the crowd, and he can kind of do the back and forth. And there's a speech that he gives, I think it's in New York,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
So he's come to the United States. He's gotten a pretty popular big turnout. How are people in the United States regarding this young, charismatic socialist black power leader at that time? Because it seems like he comes to New York and the Americans are not necessarily down with this.
Yeah. Or, I mean, I would say specifically white Americans or Americans.
Yeah, the administration.
Who are like, exactly.
The Reagan administration.
Yeah. No, the Reagan administration was definitely not down with this. There is a speech that Reagan gave from the Oval Office in early 1983, like primetime television, where he's talking about the threats that are looming with the communist, you know, this is like very like peak Cold War stuff. And he's like listing all these things that are happening in Cuba and Nicaragua. And then he mentions Grenada, and talking to Grenadians who hear this, like even they're like, wait, what? We are on national television. Like we are like one of the big threats facing the U.S. And so, you know, from that point forward, you know, there's a sense that Reagan is very antagonistic to Grenada. And I think, you know, you could argue that there is some fairness to that, right? That the Cuban Missile Crisis hadn't been that long ago, and
mm-hmm.
that the imagining that Grenada could become another Cuba was part of what was animating what you were
Soviet
hearing.
Base in the Caribbean.
Yeah, exactly. But that once Bishop comes to the U.S. for a visit, he is trying to get a meeting with Reagan, and the White House is like, no, you are not going to get a meeting with Reagan, especially because you're essentially besties with Fidel Castro. Mm-hmm. And Bishop is clearly very frustrated by this. And then he goes to Hunter College, where he gives a speech to a largely Caribbean American audience. But they're, you know, they're like Black Americans or white people. They're, you know, all kinds of like people who just are into his ideas are mm-hmm. showing up to this thing. It's mm-hmm. packed. There's like an overflow crowd outside listening on speakers. And the way that he can kind of command this room and make it sound so silly that the U.S. government thinks that Grenada is a threat, but at the same time is really talking about what is threatening about Grenada, which is this is a country of English-speaking Black people who mm-hmm. are doing things our own way,
yeah.
and that we aren't going to take BS from any other country, including the U.S. They can't tell us what to do, and that Grenada and other Caribbean islands are often thought of as, you know, these islands in America's backyard. And the line from the speech that everyone remembers is, you know, we are nobody's backyard.
Mm.
And it's just it's powerful for the people in the room. I mean, even watching that speech the first time, I remember seeing it, and that was one of the moments where I was like, oh. This should be in a podcast.
Really?
Like the way that he speaks is so powerful and it's so palpable when you hear him.
Yeah.
What, you know, why his ideas resonated with so many other people.
Yeah. And he, and the oration, there's a musicality to his voice. I mean, he's mm-hmm. just kind of, he seems kind of like born to the role. I mean, you know, right?
Yeah.
How, obviously, you know, President Reagan was, you know, suspicious is putting it mildly, really accusing Grenada of essentially trying to become this, you know, communist outposts, and he made a big deal about the fact that they were building an international airport and mm-hmm. questioning why do they need such a big airport? It must be because they want to land military planes. How much of the antagonism from the Reagan administration was also fueled by the fact that he was a Black leader? I mean, is it fear of socialism and communism, or is it that plus the Black power element? How do they kind of combined together for Reagan?
Yeah, I think that's a pretty big question that you could argue over. For Grenadians, I think they felt a lot of it was about the fact that this was a Black country. Mm-hmm. And what did that say to Black Americans about what they should be tolerating from their own government?
Right.
And even, you know, there's a couple lines where Maurice Bishop is sort of like poking fun at the experiences of Black Americans in the room, where, you know, he's describing here are all the things that we have been able to achieve in terms of healthcare and education, and like you in the U.S., like can you see a doctor for free whenever you want, like paid for by the government? So I think what honestly Maurice Bishop liked to talk about was that, oh, this isn't about communism. This is about Black people being powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, the U.S. government would probably argue with that. At some point, Maurice Bishop cites this like secret State Department report that's like that apparently says that the U.S. government is worried that that English-speaking Black people in Grenada can have a dangerous appeal to Black Americans. And we went looking for that report, and we didn't find it. And I think there's reason to be skeptical about whether that actually was a secret State Department report.
Mm-hmm.
But it's part of the message that Bishop was saying, and it clearly was resonating with people when you hear the reaction of the crowd there. And it's just, yeah, like you can tell that for him is working as an argument, and that's why he wants to bring it up again and again.
Yeah.
And again.
So Bishop becomes prime minister, and he's there at a time of this, you know, tremendous antagonism with the United States, but they're trying to build an idea of a more just society and, you know, in a socialist society in Grenada. Talk about the period, though, that leads up to his assassination. Why was he dangerous? Why did he have enemies?
Yeah. Well, a lot of it comes down to, I would say, to Grenada's relationship with the U.S. So things are, you know, there's an increasing amount of antagonism. Reagan's talking about Grenada on national television, how this place is a big threat. And so it feels like Grenada is almost under attack, right? That there's this feeling internally of, like, we need to be stronger to be able to defend against the fact that the U.S. is trying to undermine us. They might even invade our country at some point. I mean, you know, they thought about Bay of Pigs in Cuba. Could that happen to us? People talked about there was a military exercise that happened slightly earlier in the 80s called Amber and the Amberdeens that was basically like war games that the U.S. was doing that where they practiced an invasion of a Caribbean island that sounds sort of similar to Grenada and the Grenadines, which is another island chain just a bit north. But that they saw that as like, oh, the U.S. is practicing an invasion of our country. It's going to happen. And so there's a sense in Grenada of like, okay, we need to like get serious about counter-revolutionaries, about people who might be trying to bring down the revolution from the inside. There was a bombing at some point where several children were killed. They blamed that bombing on the CIA, though there's not necessarily evidence of that. But because there's this feeling of like, okay, we have to crack down, we have to find the counter-revolutionaries, we have to root out the people who are giving, you know, information to the U.S., people start turning on each other, mm-hmm. and it starts to be this situation of like, well, are you truly like, are you with the movement, or mm-hmm. Are you not? And that starts to exacerbate some like internal tensions, and then all of a sudden you have people who are looking at each other with a lot of suspicion that are supposed to be allies, and those suspicions just start to spin out of control, and then you have these different factions within the government, and which ones are plotting to take over the government, yeah. kill the other ones, and it's just like this escalation that happens leading up until October of 1983. And what ultimately happened was Bishop was executed by a group of soldiers who, at least prosecutors argued in court later, that his former deputy prime minister was the person who ordered his execution. And so it's like this very sad story of people who literally grew up together. I mean, Bishop and his deputy prime minister, a guy named Bernard Cord, as teenagers, they were like doing speeches together in the market square, and they were buds who were exchanging all these cool ideas of the stuff that they were reading. And here you are, you know, not that much later where they are, yeah, things spin out so out of control that there is an execution.
And it really, I mean, the personal nature of this, I mean, something that's so powerful in the story, as you said, I mean, these are two young men who grew up with one another, and they're making these just incredibly fateful decisions. You know, you were able to go back and find people, you know, who were there, sometimes relatives of people who had been killed. Was it difficult to get them to relive this, you know, in an interview? Were they eager to talk about it? Did they not want to talk about it?
I would say there was a big range, but honestly, I do think it was, in most cases, somewhat difficult, in part because a lot of them feel like they have talked about it so much over the years, especially in, you know, after like the late 90s when things started to open up a little bit more and there were more efforts to kind of talk about this openly, that they have a ceremony every year where they, you know, honor the people who were executed and some of the other people who were killed in the circumstances of that day, which we could talk more about. But at the ceremony every year, it's like that's the moment when people have to kind of like share again the story of where they were on October 19th and who they saw killed and what happened and when they heard the guns go off at the fort and they knew that Maurice Bishop and their family member was dead. And it's a lot for people. And I think I think what the case that we were able to make that I think got more people to talk to us about this was that we're not just trying to tell the story of the revolution again, though I would say that in the U.S. that story isn't told enough and that like more Americans need to hear that story.
Yeah, I mean, it was news to me.
Yeah. But we're also trying to solve this mystery around what happened, yes, to the bodies. And like this is all in service of being able to tell a story that leads to us kind of unpacking what information exists that could provide some answers and could prompt more people to provide answers in the future potentially. Yeah. So that's how we kind of had to convince people to share the story again.
Yeah. And talk a bit about that day, October 19th. I mean, kind of how does it begin? And it's very sudden, and you know, and you kind of deal with this fairly early on in the podcast too, but what were sort of the events of that day that led to Bishop and so many of his colleagues being assassinated.
Yeah. So on the morning of October 19th, Bishop is under house arrest at his house. His soldiers are guarding him there. He's been there for a while. Basically, his supporters in the country were like, this is crazy. This is our prime minister who's under house arrest, like from the by the military. This doesn't make any sense. Like, we need to go free him and like send a message that this is who we want as our prime minister, and that these other people who are trying to take over the government, like, we're not tolerating. And so this really started as essentially a student protest that you had kids, like 12, 13, 14-year-old kids who were deciding that they're not going to go to school, and they're going to like gather in the big squares in town, and they're going to go up to the house, and they're going to break open the gate, and they're going to free Maurice Bishop. And it basically worked. Like, they get him out of
12. Amazing thing of 12-year-olds being so like politically minded.
Yes, exactly.
American 12-year-olds aren't usually worrying about this.
Yeah, but that was such a big part of the revolution, is that you had all these kids who were like so engaged with this and who were so excited about it. But so yeah, this big group frees him from house arrest and then takes him to, they're sort of like marching through the streets and takes him to this fort that's right in the middle of town. And it's also the headquarters for the military. And so he goes there and he's like, okay, like, this is it. We're going to regroup here, and then I'm going to make a big speech, you know, telling the world, like, yes, I am still prime minister. And he's there with his supporters and cabinet members, and then basically this other faction of the government and with members of the military supporting them. They basically like reattack the fort, or, you know, counterattack, and that they kill a bunch of people in the process. They're shooting at the masses. They're shooting at Bishop and others. It's a like incredibly chaotic, horrible moment. I mean, people describe even now this fort. It's sort of positioned kind of on a hilltop that overlooks the rest of downtown. It's a honestly beautiful location. And there are all these stories of people who are trying to get away from the shooting, who jump over the side of the fort and fall to the boulders that are 50 or 60 feet below. And so that all happens. And then finally, Bishop and his cabinet members are marched out. The rest of the fort is kind of has mostly emptied out. And then they the soldiers tell Bishop and his supporters to stand up against a wall, and then they shoot them with machine guns, essentially. And what was horrible is that not everyone could see what was happening, but because this is right in the middle of downtown, you have all these stories of people who are at the hospital right next door, or in their houses, or like near to this fort, who can hear the machine guns coming out of nowhere, and just that feeling of knowing that like this is the sound of Maurice Bishop being murdered. It's a really, I mean, you can understand why it's so traumatic for people to talk about.
Yeah, completely. And so this then begins the mystery, right?
Yes.
Of what happened to the body. Now, I want people to hear the podcast, so we're not going to give away too much, but give us some sense of what happens next, and, you know, the idea of, you know, the empty grave, and kind of the theories that start to then move about in Grenada of what the heck happened here. Because this is also where the U.S. government starts to play a pretty significant role.
Yeah. So basically, in the direct aftermath of the shooting, the bodies, already family members of these people are like, nobody's giving me back the bodies, right? Like, and it's a chaotic situation. There's a curfew so no one is allowed to leave their houses. So there's a lot that's going on beyond just these bodies are missing. But these family members have already started to ask Bishop's murderers, please, can you at least give us the bodies back? So that's essentially the situation for a week. And then the U.S. invades. Reagan decides, you know, there's this level of violence happening in this country that is intolerable. There are also Americans who happen to be living on this island. There was a med school, which we can also talk about, but that there were hundreds of American med school students who Reagan thought needed to be rescued, or needed that the U.S. needed to make sure that they weren't taken hostages.
And that's a big part of his public justification on this, too.
Yeah, exactly. That these med school students, it's going to be the next Iran hostage crisis, and we need to prevent that. So the U.S. invades, and then essentially 6 days after Bishop is killed, the U.S. is now in control of the island and in control of what's going on with the government, with law enforcement. And so that's where it starts to get complicated, where there's this question of, okay, so when exactly did these bodies disappear and who had control of them when they did disappear? And there's this window at the beginning where it's like, okay, the people who murdered Bishop are in control of the island and maybe something happened then. Then there's this later window where it's like the U.S. is in control and maybe something happened then. And we've been trying to look at both those windows and figure out what do we know about what happened to the bodies first and where they went and then what happened to the bodies after that. And how can we pin down, like, who's responsible here? And then where did the bodies go? Like, where are they? And maybe, you know, they were thrown in the ocean is a theory that a lot of people have put out. So maybe they don't exist anymore. Maybe they do. And that's what we've been trying to figure out.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
Hey, Lawfare listeners, Ben Wittes here. I want to tell you about the first time I got a report from the folks at Delete Me. It was shortly after I started using the service back in 2022, and they sent me their first privacy report. I have since gotten 8 others, and it contained some shocking information. They had removed my data from 56 separate data brokers, that this had included 133 separate records, including 621 individual pieces of personal information. The data broker with the most information about me was a company I'd never heard of called People by Name. And here's the thing. Since then, every couple of months, I've gotten another privacy report from Delete Me, and it always contains more information that they have removed from the data brokers about me. In the second report, they informed me they had removed my stuff from 41 data brokers and that the one with the most information about me was called HLEC. I have no idea what HLEC is. So the other day, I got my latest report, and it includes 15 more data brokers with my personal information, 113 pieces of personally identifiable information. Big culprit this time is something called My Life. Well, I want to tell you that they don't have My Life anymore. And that is why I recommend Delete Me. As this little anecdote shows, there's a lot of my data out there, and these companies keep acquiring it and making it available to anybody who can pay. And I have slept a little bit more easily ever since I found a solution to this problem. And I want to stress, as I do every time, that I started using this before Delete Me started advertising with Lawfare. Delete Me finds and removes any personal information you don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. And that's the point of this little story, that, you know, they keep coming back. You can get it removed once, but they'll put it back. And then Delete Me comes and takes it off again. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent
potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. DeleteMe sends you regular personalized privacy reports, just like the ones I've been describing, showing what info they found where they found it, and what they removed. And critically, as this story reflects, it isn't just a one-time service. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. It does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information off the web. Data brokers hate DeleteMe, which is why I like it. Your profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for DeleteMe, now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your DeleteMe plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use promo code lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code lawfare20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/lawfare20, code lawfare20.
And this is where the podcast really, it becomes a detective story. And you know, and you and your producing partner, Ted Muldoon, are, you're down there in Grenada, you're talking to people, you're going through government documents, you're finding people, Americans who were there at the time. I mean, did it feel kind of like you were, you know, like on doing a private investigation sometimes? Like, we're going to solve this?
Yeah. The biggest frustration, honestly, was the fact that this was 40 years ago. And you have people for whom the events around October 19th and around the disappearance of the body, that this is all, like, burned into their brain. And there are people who are like, oh, I barely remember a lot of this, especially people in the U.S. military who are like, I showed up in this random country for 5 days.
Yeah.
It was weird. I didn't really understand what we were doing there.
Yeah.
And, like, here are the two memories I have.
It's like how most Americans remember it. It's like, oh, yeah, we did that for a week, right?
Yeah, exactly.
It's like invading Panama. It's like, oh, that happened.
Yeah. But then you're finding people with memories where they're like, oh, yeah, and then we, you know, showed up to this pit and we're collecting some bodies from the pit. And it's like, oh, that you don't understand. That's incredibly important memory that now I need to understand every detail about, because the details could mean, you know, either X scenario or Y scenario.
Right.
And so, yeah, it has been a lot of the detective work of tracking down people and, you know, like a Jamaican soldier remembering the last name of some American that he interacted with, and now we're trying to 40 years later track down this American who he talked to, and
Did you have the experience that some investigative reporters have with their subjects, where they look at you and like, why the hell are you so interested in this?
Yes, yeah, exactly. Especially Americans who, I mean, I think Grenadians, of course, are like, oh yeah,
this I get is, it. Yeah,
people talk about this all the time, but Americans, I think, are even Americans who spent time in Grenada are like, wait, they never found his body? Like, I didn't know that, or why are people asking questions about this? But what Grenadians say that I think is a compelling argument is that the U.S. is also, like, obsessed with making sure that we have the remains of people who were killed, especially abroad. You know, the fact that there are still so many efforts to identify people who died in combat in World War II or Vietnam or whatever. And
absolutely.
Grenadians are like, we just want the same thing.
Both
like, we're just
thing.
Asking for one group of people that we'd really like to be able to bury. And Grenadians have felt that the U.S. government in particular hasn't been that helpful in the years since in trying to track down those answers.
Which certainly adds to a lot of the theory that maybe the U.S. government had something to do with disappearing his remains and others.
Mm-hmm.
So taking a step back from the story for a second, talk about how you got interested in this story. I can remember, I think, 2 years ago, you kind of like laying this on me, like, I got this idea.
Yeah.
Which was super intriguing. But talk about how you knew about Bishop, the what about this particular part of the story kind of, you know, stuck with you, and why you decided to go off on this journey.
Yeah. I I don't think I would have encountered this story at all if my parents didn't live in Grenada. My parents aren't from Grenada. I'm not from Grenada, which I always feel like I have to make clear. But my mom is from Trinidad, which is like the next island town from Grenada.
Right.
And my parents retired about 7 years ago, and then they decided that they were going to retire to Grenada, which if you have seen pictures of this place, you'll understand why, because it's incredibly beautiful. And essentially anywhere you are in the country has like a great view of the ocean. Once they moved there and kind of got set up and started to like reconnect with friends or make new friends, I'd go down and visit them. And it was always like, it was like they'd have people over for dinner. And then, you know, there's like one or two or three rum punches. Uh-huh. And by the time dinner's over, and it, like, that's when like the like quote unquote old chat gets serious.
Yeah, yeah.
And people would start talking about this stuff around like Bishop and the revolution, and were there spies in Grenada? Like, there must have been, like, the U.S. must have had CIA here. Like, there was this guy that I always interacted with, and I always thought maybe he's a spy. And so it's just like stuff gets aired. And then you hear about this question around the bodies, and like, well, a friend of a friend told me that he actually saw that they did this other thing, or that maybe the bodies were actually buried on the other side of the island, or they were taken to Carriacou, or, you know, like, it's just, and having basically explored all these theories now in what I think I'm confident in saying is the most rigorous
investigation ever.
Yeah. It's, you know, like not all these theories hold up, but I think the fact that they were coming up again and again was really intriguing to me. And and then I actually did a story about the revolution and the end of the revolution and the executions for NPR Throughline, which is a wonderful podcast of people that I admire so much. And I was so lucky to be able to work with them on telling that story. And so even in doing that story, I'd get emails from people that were like, oh, I'm from Grenada, or my parents are from Grenada, and I really appreciate you like talking about this history. And also, like, there's this thing about the bodies that you should know. Have you heard about the thing with the bodies? Like, the bodies are missing. Like, maybe you should look into that. And at first, I was like, I don't really know how much there is that I could bring to this, because it feels like this is 40 years ago. I don't know, you know, I don't know the people who would have been in a position to interact with like what was happening to the bodies right after they were executed. But once I started to do a little research, I was like, oh, wait, like a lot of this stuff is documented, or like these accounts actually do make sense, or like there are real questions here that are legitimate questions that have some kind of backing to them. And I feel like the further I went, the more I was like, well, has anyone really asked the U.S. about this? And they have asked the U.S., but they've asked in sort of like general, like they just kind of go to the State Department, are like, do you have the bodies? And the State Department's like, no, we don't.
No.
We don't know. We don't know where the bodies are. We don't have the bodies. Why are you asking us? But that, you know, but that I could see the kind of like avenues of like, oh, but has anyone asked these people and like this particular group in the military and this particular group in the State Department? And like, have people just like gone and heard what they had to say and what they saw? And that's when I felt like, okay, working at the Washington Post and having colleagues who are great in, you know, helping to like guide that kind of reporting and thinking, like maybe this is worth us kind of taking more seriously and really going at it and trying to figure out if there are more answers to be gotten here.
Yeah, because it's a real reporting project at that point, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, you say, because you have all of these questions that you can try to answer. It's not necessarily a matter of sifting through what's the more reasonable story I heard around the dinner table. It's like I can actually interrogate these questions.
Yes, yes, exactly.
What made you want to do it as a podcast? I mean, obviously you were hosting a podcast at the time, so that's the natural vehicle for it. But you mentioned, you know, hearing that speech that Bishop gave at Hunter College and in the sound of his voice. Mm-hmm. I mean, was there something innately appealing about this as an audio project, an audio story?
Yeah, I think that was part of it. I mean, I feel really proud of having a mom who's a West Indian, and I love her accent and I love the accents of my family members. And I just like the idea of making a Washington Post podcast in which you hear like every different type of, you know, of Grenadian, Trinidadian, Barbadian, Jamaican accents. Yes. I mean, I think it's I was very enamored with the idea of being able to make something like that. But I think a lot of it was also about the reporting process. And I know that what I love hearing in podcasts is a sense of taking you kind of behind the scenes and following along with a host or a narrator or a reporter as they're trying to figure out what they know and going down wrong turns and then getting to the right place and having surprising moments. And my hope was that with this, we could do a little bit of that, of bringing listeners on a journey with me and with my reporting partners. You mentioned Ted Muldoon and also Renny Sprenofsky, like coming with us as we're trying to figure out who knows what and like tracking down these people from 40 years ago who are like, how did you find me? It's been 40 years since anyone's asked me about
that.
It's
amazing, right? That must be. That's very gratifying, probably as a reporter too. That you get to like somebody's happy that you're taking their story seriously.
Yeah, totally.
And I'm glad you mentioned the different accents too, because it's one of the things that's so enjoyable about hearing the voices. Is you do like. I'm thinking it's not just me, right? I'm hearing all of these subtle variations and differences. There's the one guy you found. I'm going to blank on his name, but you tracked him down. He wasn't on Grenada. He was on a different island.
Barbados.
Yeah, and you found him at his church.
Yes.
And
his
accent almost sounded Irish.
Yes. Yeah. That's
it
actually
a brogue to it.
Yes, you're picking up on, wow, you can tell the differences in Caribbean accents.
But that was so cool because you kind of, but that also helps like situate, I think, the listener, because you do kind of feel like you're hopping around to these different locations and it's kind of, you're following along as you guys are sort of hunting down the path and everything. And there's the sound of the frogs in the background, you know, that kind of becomes part of the, you know, the almost like the soundtrack.
Well, that was honestly a problem for us because, and so if you listen to the first episode, there's this moment where we basically play the sound of the frogs and then I talk briefly about like, yeah, and there are these frogs that you can hear anywhere on the island and you can even hear them when I'm. You know, in D.C. talking to my parents on the phone, you can hear them through WhatsApp. But the problem was these frogs were in all of our tape. Like,
everywhere.
Anytime that we interviewed, like the moment an interview went past 5 p.m., all of a sudden there are frogs in the background of this interview now. They come through the windows. And also, you know, it's Grenada, so like everything's very open and people tend to have houses that just you can't like block out all the sound. And so so we just had to explain why these frogs are in all of the tape. Like even the you know, very somber announcements made by the general saying like Maurice Bishop has been killed. Like you can hear the frogs in the background of that tape. So they're everywhere.
It's just the music of Grenada.
And we should
say a word too about the music too, because I think Ted did some original music and some mixing for it, and you had others too that did original stuff.
So Ted did the sound design and he did a little bit of the music, but we were able to hire a musician in Trinidad, Keshav Chandranath Singh, who is incredibly talented. He's a soca artist, and if you don't know what soca is, it's kind of modern, very like poppy Trinidadian music. It's great music that I love. It's like all upbeat, and it's music that you dance to, and Keshav like plays at music festivals and stuff. So that gives you like a sense of his, I guess, usual audience. And so when we were able to connect with him, and he did a demo for us that we were really impressed by, and the idea was like, how do you take Caribbean music that I think is so known for being upbeat and happy, and how do you make that somber? How do you make that even spooky? And he did such a fantastic job of thinking about, okay, how can you use Steel Pan in a way that is haunting rather than like exciting? And one of the touchstones we had in talking about the music for a while is, do you remember the trailer for Us, the Jordan Peele movie?
Yes.
There's a song, I Got Five on it, but it's like a cover of that song that's like slow and dark and like so spooky.
Uh-huh.
And we were like, how do you make I Got Five on it, the spooky
that's
version,
it.
But for Calypso? And
oh, that's great.
Yeah.
And it does work too, because it has a haunting kind of almost like it's scary. It's a little bit nostalgic.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it just kind of has all of the trappings of what I think that you need for the canvas that you're working on.
Yeah. I that makes me feel really good to hear, because I just love like being able to show Caribbean music and Caribbean instruments in a slightly different way.
Mm-hmm.
And we could go really deep on this, but, you know, steel pan, the instrument, which is invented in Trinidad, but, you know, people play pan in Grenada and Barbados and other parts of, especially that part of the Caribbean, that it's, you know, it has this, like, I just feel like it's the music that you hear when you're going to some sort of like beach bar in Key West,
exactly.
And then it's like kind of hokey, and it's just like a lot of covers of like The Little Mermaid.
Yes.
I don't know. But it's such a like a cool instrument with this really interesting history, because steel pan came out of kind of like anti-colonialist movements were made originally out of like oil drums of people who were working for British oil companies and were, you know, like trying to bring about like workers' movements, and just it's such a rich instrument that I think can speak to a lot of different feelings and emotions, and it was cool to be able to highlight some of that musical history in a different way, or kind of bring a different tonality to like what makes Caribbean music Caribbean.
Yeah, because it sounds familiar, but not. Do you know what I mean? Does that make sense? I mean, the instrument sounds familiar, but the melody, the tone of it sounds like not something you're used to hearing. And that's probably because a lot of audiences, you know, are probably not used to hearing it unless you're paying attention to Caribbean music.
Yeah.
And you mentioned your mom, too, and she's in the first episode. Was your family like excited about you digging into this? I'm kind of curious. We talked about like Maurice Bishop and his parents, and you know, your parents probably have an idea about she works at the Washington Post and she does what she does there. But were they excited that you were kind of digging into this history in the place that they live?
I think they were generally. My mom was very cautious about, like, she didn't want me to harass her friends about, like.
This is kind of what I was wondering.
Yeah. Like, there was sometimes a talking to of, like, okay, so-and-so is coming over for dinner. Do not ask them your questions around Bishop's body. Like, you could do that another time, but don't do it at the table. So there was definitely some of that. My dad's not from the Caribbean at all. He's from Northern California. Yeah. But he's a big history buff. And honestly, I think he knows more about like the history of the revolution and stuff than my mom does. Only because, I mean, my mom remembers a lot of it in terms of, you know, her of hearing the news in Trinidad and stuff. Yeah. But my dad has like gone back to read the books and to kind of understand the different accounts. And so I think he was excited about like my interest in wanting to nerd out about, what would have happened if Bishop had called an election earlier, and maybe that would have changed how things eventually unfolded. And I think that he is really, really interested in this history
and eager to hear
some answers around this question and around the bodies.
That's great. How did you become a podcaster? Talk about your career of how you got into this. What I think before there was podcasting. You know, we talked in journalism a lot about like video is the future.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know that people understood that audio storytelling was going to become such a mainstay. So how did you get into this?
Wow, that's a great question. I just loved listening to audio.
Yeah.
is I think the simple way of saying it. So I was like big into journalism in high school. Like I did my school newspaper. And
where'd you grow up?
Miami.
Okay.
Great
journalism town.
Yeah. And so I grew up reading the Miami Herald, and I think that was part of it too. I'd see that. I always remember whenever there was a hurricane, especially a big one, and the Miami Herald would show up on our front lawn the next day, and I was like, oh my God, like how did they do
how
this?
Did they
put out
get
this
here?
Newspaper in the middle of a hurricane. I was doing my school newspaper in high school, and I think I just. People would tell me, you know, teachers would say that I was good at writing, and I was like, oh, I guess I'm good at writing. Maybe I should do something with that.
Yeah, I should do it with it. Yeah.
And so I kind of continued down that path and did the school newspaper in college and was very much like, okay, well, I want to be a journalist, so I guess I'm going to work at newspapers and, like, be a writer. And if I could, like, do that professionally, I would have achieved, you know, all of my dreams, and that would be in and of itself, like, a big success. But what happened was, so after college, I was an intern, and then I was hired at the Boston Globe, and I was a GA reporter, general assignment, for a few years. And oftentimes that meant, like, waking up or getting woken up early in the morning by this assignment editor. Mike Bella, if you're listening to this, shout out to you. and he would be like, okay, someone has been, you know, murdered in this part of New Hampshire, and, like, you need to go there right now to cover this press conference at 10:30 or whatever. And so a lot of my time was just in the car driving to places. And this was pre-serial. And so the podcast boom had not yet started, but there were shows like This American Life and Radiolab 99% Invisible, mm-hmm. like shows that I had started to download. I think I might have been downloading them on my iPod still.
Yeah,
at some
right.
point.
You probably had to put like the headphones on or
yeah,
something.
Yeah. And I remember because it was like the headphones in the car, and that's like probably not okay. But I just remember being in the car, listening to these stories and hearing something so special in them that I felt like I couldn't replicate in print. Mm-hmm. That I'd like be driving to this place where I'm about to talk to somebody whose loved one has died, and it's going to be incredibly like emotional. And me as a reporter, that I like hear this emotion in their voice, and I can like feel what it's like to hear them tell me about something that's incredibly important to them. And then I come back to the newsroom, and then I write it in a story, and then I read it in print, and it's like not the same.
It's not capturing it.
Yeah, and then I would hear I'd hear these stories from Radiolab or This American Life, where I was like that has the thing that I hear when I'm reporting, but that I can't like give to people. And so for like 3 or 4 years, I was like, but it's too late. I'm 22 years old, and I've already decided to be a newspaper reporter. So
I'm a GA reporter at the Globe. Yeah. This is it.
Yeah, exactly. Like I can never do podcasts. I just missed my opportunity. But then it was not actually the case. And
no.
When I came to the Post, I was covering transportation originally.
Right, you were on Metro covering transportation.
Yeah. And then to their credit, I mean, even from before I was hired, I was like, okay, I want this job, but I also want to let you know that I love audio and I want to do stuff with audio. Please
okay, so you kind of let them know that.
Yeah.
And we didn't have a daily podcast when you showed up.
Yes. And so people were like kindly sort of nodding and like, yeah, sure. Yeah, you can do audio if you want, in addition to covering a Metro beat.
You're going to do your job though, right?
Yes. Yeah, I think that was understandably the biggest concern. But it took a few years. But then eventually when they were starting on daily podcasts, and I'd been trying to like get involved in other ways. We have a politics podcast, and the host of that, she had been out on parental leave, and so I was filling in for her while I was still doing my job, and just finding like any little toehold of mm-hmm. audio to be able to make the case of, oh, I've developed a set of skills that I can that would help me be a valuable part of like the Post audio feature. And so then they started a daily podcast, and I applied for a job.
I guess I've never asked you. Did you have to? You had to audition for it, basically.
Yeah. No, it was. My audition. I interviewed David Farenthold and Carlos Lozada.
I never knew this.
Yeah. They were both very lovely, and other people.
Sadly, two colleagues no longer with us. They work for the New York Times.
Yeah. Woof. I didn't even think about that. So it was they had to be interviewed about the same story 4 different times, which
I guess they're
used to, because, you know, when you have a big story and, you know, you'll be on CNN and MSNBC or whatever.
But it's so cool that that's how the Post did it, was like the go do an interview.
Yeah. And so I was thinking about like, okay, what can I bring in particular to this interview that that maybe other people wouldn't? And so I was very lucky to get this job. But also I felt like my hope is that my passion for audio really came through, that I was like, oh, it's not even that I want to be a host on this podcast. I just want to work on this podcast.
Right.
And if it's as the host, that's great.
That's great.
It's something else too, but I just like want this podcast to be successful. And I think it's this great avenue for, you know, sharing the voices of these people that I just love working with. And in the same way of how I was feeling, you know, driving home from these stories in Boston, is that like you read a story in a front page story in the Post, and there's certainly a power to it and a clarity to it. But then I would run into that reporter, you know, like standing at the coffee shop and being like, oh, I saw your story about this. It was so good. And then they'd be describing more what it was like to report that story. And I was like, this is the best part. Like, that's the part that I want to hear. And so that's what I love about audio. And what I'm really proud of with our daily podcast is being able to share that part of what it means to be a journalist.
Yeah. And I think as someone who loves coming on the podcast, it's in kind of a reciprocal fashion. We get to talk about the story in a way that you can't get across in print. Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, not just because there's a formality to print and there's a kind of economy of language that you have to have in there. But I don't get to tell the story in a natural voice so much. Right. Mm-hmm. So going on a podcast is another way of telling the story. And I think for journalists, that's just like, it's incredibly valuable. It's not just, oh, I'm just coming on to talk about the story. It's I get to convey the story differently than I would if I was just writing it in print.
I'm glad to hear you say that.
Yeah, no, it's a real thing. And how did you feel being like the inaugural host of the Post's daily podcast? And talk about making a daily podcast, because people turn on their podcast feed and they take it for granted that it is there. It is a tremendous amount of work.
Oh yeah. Yeah, it really is. And I mean all of it is impossible without the like army. I mean, it's a small army, but it feels like a strong small army of producers who work on our podcasts who are just honestly working their butts off.
They really are.
Day in and day out to be able to make these like incredibly compelling tape-rich stories on super tight deadlines. I mean, deadlines that are down to like 15-minute marks of like, okay, if we tape with Shane at 11:45, we get the cut by like 12:40, and then we can do the like final edits by 1:15, and then it has to get to the mixer by 1:45. And so a lot of it is like really tight deadlines and people who are working really hard to make it possible. But coming in as the host, it was, I was so nervous. I don't think I ate for like 2 weeks, and I love to eat. So, I must have been in like a real form of acute stress if I like wasn't eating in the couple of weeks before it came out, because it's, you know, it's the Post and it's a big institution with a lot of history, and you want to.
And we'd never done this.
Yeah, exactly. But also the thing that I felt so strongly about that I hope is audible in Post reports and in the empty grave of Comrade Bishop and the other, you know, audio that we do is a sense of authenticity. And I just wanted, you know, that like there's a certain way that I think people talk when they're on TV, which is understandable because TV is such a different medium. But that I wanted to make sure that conversations felt like how I would be talking to someone at a dinner party or at happy hour, you know, that this is just like you and me chatting together. Yep. And if you say something that I don't understand, I'm just going to say that I don't understand it. Or, you know, that I'm like a stand-in for people who are just making their dinner and aren't that engaged with the news or don't know the latest about a story, and that we can have, you know, a real human conversation and back and forth about like trying to grapple with, okay, so like what does that mean? Like why did that happen? That was really surprising to me. Like I didn't understand that headline. And so I think that was my real priority, is kind of, trying to kind of push back against the instinct, I think, in a lot of ways to sound more authoritative or knowledgeable than you really are, and instead be myself on mic. And I don't think I always achieve that, but I generally try to.
I think that we as reporters, and we're trained for this, is we often hide behind the brand or the kind of authority of the paper, and you kind of, and it's and you know, it's fine to have, you know, I mean, it's journalism to be conveyed with a sense of authority and confidence, and it's written the same way all the time, and that can be good, but I think it makes us less accessible to the reader, and it kind of, and it puts a distance between me and the person who's reading the story, and it feels like audio, and the way specifically the audio is developed into a kind of more casual or realistic way of talking to people, and an ability to be vulnerable in audio, like the way you and I just sitting here talking, or as you said, like at a dinner party, it closes that distance. And I wonder, do you think that that makes it, does it add credibility? Like, does it make it, is it easier for the listener to kind of trust the journalist when they can hear her talking like that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, definitely. I mean, we talk about this a lot, that especially with younger audiences who are a lot more skeptical of like the Walter Cronkite voice, for lack of a better term. But that kind of projecting that we know everything, people don't buy because they know that we don't know everything, and that there is a lot of distrust in the media, or even like misunderstanding about the media and how we do our jobs and where we get information from. And so to me, it feels like the way to be able to tap into that trust and to be able to like build a sense of, you know, we are people that are working hard to try to explain things in the clearest, most accurate way possible is by speaking like real people and saying, you know, this is like not only this is the headline, but so, okay, this is the process that we went through of trying to figure out what we, you know, what we know, and this is what we don't know. And, you know, I actually had a reaction of surprise or confusion when I saw this because, like, it didn't make sense to me either. And then I talked to these other people. And I think that going through those steps meets people where they're at and also, you know, ultimately makes you more trustworthy.
Yeah, and I think in the podcast, I mean, you, Comrade Bishop, you're doing that, right? It's very much the reporter's notebook kind of format where we're following you along as you uncover the story. And there's a compelling, dramatic narrative thrust to that. But it's also incredibly honest, right? You are surprised. You do go down wrong paths. You know, you do have assumptions corrected. You do find, you know, things that are new. And I think it actually makes you as a narrator more reliable. Like, it's because it's like you're just talking like a normal person, which is just not how we're trained to do it.
And it's also hard. I mean, I think you know this better than anyone, that it's hard to turn off the part of you that wants to kind of deliver information like you are in a print story.
Yeah.
And that, you know, the one of the most challenging things in audio is to write in a way that sounds natural, even though you would think that it would
be really hard,
that it would be intuitive. But in many cases, it's
not. And are you finding that, I mean, you chose to do a story that you talk about, like, you know, like the importance of reaching younger audiences. And at the Post, we talk a lot about trying to reach younger audiences. And for listeners, it's a big thing that, like, big people with big brains are trying to spend a lot of time on right now. You chose to tell a story that's, you know, it's 40 years old. I mean, it will resonate with people in Grenada, but it's a piece of history. So what did you kind of rely on to make it relevant? I mean, you got a built-in mystery, which is great.
Yeah. I it's almost like the lack of understanding about that, or a lack of, like, knowledge of, or at least knowledge among Americans about Grenada, to me was like the strength of the story, and that, like, oh, generally no American remembers this and knows anything about this. So, like, I'm telling you a story completely from scratch.
Yep.
And I think that kind of helped to, you know, when I mentioned certain twists and turns or, like, allusions to things that I know will be surprising to most people, that we can kind of lean into the surprise, because I'm like, oh, you don't know what's going to happen. Like, if you were paying attention to, like, geopolitics in 1983, you would know what's happening next, but you weren't. So, like, now you get to be surprised, and that's great.
Yeah.
But I think it also just taps into, you know, questions that people are thinking about a lot now, and specifically, you know, like, after, what, two summers ago and pull out of Afghanistan, and like, that what it means when the U.S. invades a country, and what are, like, what are the different ways that you can view something like that? Are we rescuing people? Are we intervening? Are we, you know, like, tromping on this other country in a way that's very much, like, unappreciated, and, like, yeah, what is America's role here? What is the legacy of that? In many ways, like, this little invasion was truly the best case scenario of any American invasion, right? It's like, we go in, combat is over in 3 days, we stay for a few months, we, like, oversee a next election, and, like, by next year we are out and, like, never have to go back to Grenada. And it was a real win for Reagan. But I think even with that best case scenario, the fact that you have so many of these, like, lingering questions and kind of, like, unresolved legacies of, like, was it a good thing? Was it a bad thing? Like, why did America come here? Did it leave Grenada in a better place? Did it leave Grenada in a worse place? Like, why is it that we can't get answers on some of the things that happened while the U.S. was here? That I think that really resonates with anyone who's been paying attention to, like, the U.S. trying to figure out what is its role in the world today.
So by the time people hear this conversation, I think episode 5 will have just dropped.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to ask you to give away any endings, but, I mean, how are you feeling about the story? And, you know, should there be things that people might want to anticipate? I don't know how much you want to say.
But. Yeah, there's just a lot. I would say that I think that we left the best for last.
Oh, okay.
Like, The moments that have genuinely shocked me in the reporting are moments that we have not yet gotten to.
Oh, okay.
And I am excited for people to hear those moments.
Nice. Well, that's great. I'm excited, too, because I'm caught up and I'm just dying for the next episode.
Good,
yeah,
good.
That's good. So it is our tradition on Chatter that the very last question I ask you is contained in this, the Chatterbox.
Ooh.
So I select you. Surprise. They're pre-written questions. I select one at random.
Wow. So I love this idea. Can I steal that?
Yeah, of course.
Can this be a Post report?
Absolutely. Thing? Absolutely. Okay. I'm going to reach in here and grab it for it. I hope it's a good one. Okay. Oh, actually, I think this is a good one. This goes with various themes that we've been talking about. In what country other than your own would you most like to live and why?
Oh, I mean, it depends on how long you're talking about living.
Let's say 3 years minimum, let's just say.
3 years.
Doesn't necessarily mean, like, for the rest of your life.
I feel like this is too thematically similar, but so I lived in Trinidad for a year when I was in my 20s, and I would love to go back.
Yeah.
And I just think it's like this fascinating, like, crazy place that has, you know, all kinds of problems that are very similar to the U.S.'s problems, but very different from the U.S.'s problems too. And I just think that, like, the English-speaking Caribbean, mm-hmm. you know, we talk a lot about Cuba and of course Haiti, the DR, you know, like that the part of the Caribbean that's closer to the U.S. For lots of understandable reasons, I think is what we talk about in, you know, when it comes to like how this place is affected by the world and its effect on the rest of the world. But I think the bottom of the Caribbean is like the coolest place, and it has all these crazy intersections of like different parts of the world that I just love, and Trinidad in particular. I could go back there, live for another 3 years happily, yeah. write and make and produce a bunch of stories, and that would be my dream.
I love this. You could open the Trinidad Bureau of the Washington Post.
Honestly, from your lips to God's ears.
I mean,
I just bought a house in D.C., so I don't know if that's like necessarily in the cards anymore. But it would be, yeah. I have like a whole list of stories that I'm like ready to pump out for the Washington Post if they'd let me live in Trinidad.
We got a new publisher. Now's the time to get in there with this idea.
Yeah.
He's looking for ideas.
Yeah.
But Martine Powers, my friend, this has been so much fun.
Thank you for
doing this. Thank you for making this podcast, The Empty Grave of Comrade
thank
Bishop.
You for listening.
It's terrific. It is a great story. You're going to learn so much. People are going to have a great time. It is a tremendous mystery. I can't wait to see what happens. And I'm so grateful you came on to talk about it. Thanks.
Thank you for having me. This is such an honor and a pleasure.
That was Chatter, a production of Lawfare and Goat Rodeo. Please subscribe to the podcast and find us on Twitter at That Was Chatter.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.